Chapter 24. Groom the child in the art of conversation. A. Why didn't you turn up? B. What makes you think so? A. What time were you there? B. What time did we agree on? A. Wasn't it 9? B. Hadn't you said that would be late? A. So what time did you come? B. Precisely 8 as agreed. At last the chain of questions countered by questions is broken and the simple information sought became eventually availed. This is an example of questions being denied information by counter questions. It is an ugly habit, which is not only annoying and time-wasting but also ill-mannered. Some children are normally found with this habit. Sadly, many of them grow up hardening the habit. They cannot be said to have cultivated congenial disposition. They fail to retain friends. What is worse, the marriage is put at risk if one of the spouses has the habit of responding to questions with questions. A wife cautiously asked the husband after a few days of the marriage, "Why do you have the habit of avoiding answering a question by a counter-question?" His reply was, "Who says this? Ugly habit." The purpose of conversation is communication, which mainly includes exchanging or imparting information and not avoiding it, and yet. How often we come across the annoying examples of the purpose being defeated quite innocently by this ugly habit. A polished or refined personality is reflected mainly in the art of conversation. There may be a person who is intelligent, sharp and highly educated and yet he will have failed to master the art. Similarly, a person may look distinguished in appearance, stature or in his walking gait to strangers but is known to his friends and acquaintances as having no matching personality because he lacked the art of conversation. A person is groomed in the art of conversation either from his childhood or learns by emulating the examples of those who have impressed him by their practice of the art. It is part of the elementary grooming when parents keep reminding children to say, "Please, thank you, may I, alhamdulillah, praise to Allah, inshallah, Allah willing, etc., in the course of conversation. Poor personality. Looking sideways or darting the eyes here and there while talking to a single person. Raising voice unnecessarily. Over-gesticulation or dramatization, talking fast or unduly excessive talking, liberal changes of face expression or tone of the voice, interruptions or exclamatory interjections, head movement to show disagreement while the person is still talking, all these show a lack of the art of conversation. Children should be taught to avoid every one of these. They reflect a poor personality in an adult. The contents, choice of words, the style of expression and the timing are also important. Even more important is the expression of face when conversation is punctuated with arguments or contentions. A thin smile playing on the lips while about to reply instead of a frown or stern eyeing would signal a gentle and sincere and therefore effective disagreement without inviting quarrel. Avoiding a lengthy discussion of an important subject in the street or raising it only if the time and place met is mutually convenient is also a peripheral part of the art. Children should be taught never to say the same thing twice in the same conversation. Punctuation of "you see, okay, I mean" and the likes must be stopped before the habit takes root. The child with the habit will make a poor speaker. Children normally are short of vocabulary. The right adverbs and adjectives are the real problem. So listen to this: the soccer player kicked the ball boom. I, meaning yardle. It flew shoo, meaning fast, towards the goal. But the goalie tipped it fupe. Meaning quickly, over the bar. Some children get even worse in this when adults. Imposing or capitulation. A new teacher makes his first appearance before a class, which is notorious for misbehavior in the presence of any teacher. A janitor cleaning the corridor becomes curious, seeing the class unusually quiet. This was because the class had not yet sized up the teacher while he was standing expressionless before them and had not yet spoken a single word. For a stranger, silence is a shield. Less talk is imposing. Excessive talk is capitulation. The proposals of many a good suitor were declined because they demonstrated the weakness of excessive talking during their self-introduction. One does not win in capitulation. The parents who set themselves to minding the habits of the children in their conduct of conversation can groom the children in the art. The parents will have minded their own habits also in the process. Chapter 25. The Child and His World of Fantasy. The married son with a child was more than happy with his employment in a prestigious international company. The position, the salary, the fringe benefits and the annual increments were all enviable until that morning, when he learnt that the senior position above him was to fall vacant and someone younger from another branch was to fill it because according to the rules that position was for a university graduate. He was not a graduate. The son informed his parents of his decision to quit his employment. He would work and prosper in employment elsewhere. Yes. And he would rise through successive promotions and reach a position even much higher, that of the chief executive, and they would be proud of his successes, of course, his modest basic education notwithstanding. The son's fantasy of the successes awaiting him, despite the reality on the ground indicating to the contrary, reminded the parents of similar refuge in fantasy to which the son would resort when he was a boy. Fantasy of successes. As one past example, the administrators of a youth sports complex would not I include the boy in any of the sports teams for a league competition that season, I because of his lack of minimum hours of prior practice according to the established I rules. He declined the offer of inclusion in parallel friendly games outside the competition. Instead, he chose to confront the administrators on the rules, assuring his parents of what appeared to them a mere fantasy of predictions of his successful confrontation. He lost both the fight in the confrontation and a participation in that season. We can understand when a child makes a visitation to his world of fantasy by applying more fantasy than hard reasoning in the attempt to solve his problems or achieve his aspirations, because at that age his ability to grasp the reality on the ground is limited and his past experiences are almost none. It is therefore normal for children also to fantasize themselves in the roles of their heroes and see themselves able to perform even better than them, to the extent that the feats fancied are superhuman. Fanciful dreams. It is normal for a child also to talk, or bag, about his fanciful dreams of what he wants to be or do then or when he is grown up. Their dreams have no or little relation to the hard reasoning or the practical aspects of life. However, parents should not commit the mistake of laughing off the child's fanciful dreams as a normal passage of a phase of childhood, if the child continues with the luxury of fantasy as he grows up or is found gaining more and more comfort by taking a refuge in his world of fantasy. The child will be aspiring for more than what is practical or indeed praiseworthy, within his normal ability. Upon failing to advance towards his fanciful aspirations, he will create yet one more world of his own for refuge, and that is the one of self-pity. Realm of Reasoning. Children should be seen making lesser and lesser visitations to their world of fantasies and more to the realm of reasoning as they grow up and begin to realize that when facts cannot be changed, the attitude has to be changed. A refuge in a world of fantasy while waiting for the facts to change is an unhealthy trait. Sadly, there are those among children who, instead of growing out of the fantasy visitation, grow up with the habit of taking a refuge in fanciful planning devoid of reasoning. This is because they would not want to accept facts over which they have no control, nor change their attitude over which they have control. However, this weakness varies in degrees from person to person. There was this guest who got busy pouring out his frustration to the host at the arrival reception of the airport. He said he was late in checking out because there were the health immigration and customs procedures to comply with. And that was not all, there were the baggage to identify and collect. He did not say that all other passengers were doing the same and many were still behind in the queue. He had a cause for the frustration because he had fancied coming across different facts or changing them, at least for himself in his travel. No person need be a victim of having to create a fanciful substitute world of his own to overcome the vicissitudes of the real world, and fail worse. What is required is that he is impressed since his childhood that there is a better and eternal world to look forward to, much better than the human fantasy can conjure or conceive. He will understand the purpose of this transient world and accept that it is attendant with test, tribulation and tears. He will bring himself much nearer to knowing Islam and transit himself with a comfortable conviction. He will be a contented man with his priorities right, whatever the reality on the ground may confront him. Chapter 26. The Child's Books and Buddies. A parent on meeting his next-door neighbor, also a parent, in a communal corridor of the same building thanked him profusely for devoting some of his leisure time to coaching his child, also together with his own in-school lessons after the dinner time. He was pleased that his child had been showing great improvement in his school work since his regular visits to the neighbor's apartment. The neighbor, surprised and also embarrassed, replied that it was hardly a bother to him to let both the children talk to him about their work and marks as he cursorily browsed through the pages of their exercise books and then gave them back with a word or two of compliments. It did not take him more than 5 minutes for each of them. The neighbor added that he wished he had more time to spare for the children, but then he brought the shop accounts home for daily posting. These kept him busy till bedtime. The visits started when the child found that the neighbor's child regularly showed to his father his schoolwork and talked his marks of the day with him, while his own father showed no similar interest whenever he wanted to talk his work with him. His father did not want to be disturbed when he was watching TV programs, which ended when the child was already fast asleep. So the neighbor's child was moved by sympathy and made an offer, "Why don't you come over to my place and you too show your work to my dad?" A word of compliment. Regular interest of the parents in the child's work, at least by mere inspection of his books for a few minutes, serves as a great boost to the child's confidence and efforts to do well in the school. A word of compliment costs nothing but would save a good deal of costs if the child so complimented completed his studies sooner and with higher ranks. There will continue to be TV programs. If that is the lasting interest of the father, when he is old and cared for by the son when adult, the son will have become financially fairly settled, through good education, to facilitate this leisure for his father. If the importance of inspection of the school books of the child can be appreciated, so should the importance of investigation of the buddies, close friends, of the child. The importance of the two is linked for a successful completion of the child's education. It is the bad buddies more than the good ones who can cast a greater influence on the child. Their companionship serves as a source of encouragement or prodding for all that which is restrained or restricted by the parents. It is therefore attractive to the child. The examples are an unbridled liberty of movement and loafing about, truancy, relaxation in the discipline, unruly group behavior in the streets and other public places, and worse still, immoral inclination. What is even more attractive to that child who is well under disciplinary control at home and apparently worthy of the parents' trust is the sense of sharing secrets among the friends and loyalty to each other with regard to their secrets of misbehavior outside home. Collective adventurism? In fact, children are tempted to misbehave among their friends out of collective adventurism for its sake. The adventure of sailing across the previously uncharted waters, of the excitement of permissiveness in a group, all urging one another to paddle on, is the greater pull than the products of the adventure. And yet the products can include serious addictions which hook some of the children to ruin their prospects for good education and ethics. It is such an alluring spectrum of friendship which poses the risk of the child's obedience to his parents to become eroded and subordinated or tampered by his collective loyalty with other children to their peers among the friends. The child may be uncomfortably unwell or indisposed. He would, however, not reveal his state of health to his parents for fear of being grounded at home and missing seeing his friends, or he would still slip out to meet them against the instruction of the parents, which was to take rest. Parents should have a cause for concern, and begin a discreet investigation if the child's attachment and loyalty to his group of friends are disproportionately this much excessive. To have friends and want to be with them almost regularly is not only normal but also healthy for the child. However, this normalcy imposes a great responsibility upon the parents. It is essential, therefore, that the parents keep a track of the movements and behavior of the child outside the home. They should get to knowing closely his friends individually by inviting them home and maintaining regular contact with them through the child, to the extent that the parents should also show some interest in knowing their performances and conduct in the school, so as to be reassured and relieved regarding the caliber of the child's close companions. What is more important is for the child to be made aware of the temporary phase of the temptation for the adventurism which is attendant with the risks of the child acquiring certain permanent addictions in result. Chapter 27. Allow the child his moments of privacy. The son got married. The lingering display of the henna-dyed decorative patterns on the hands of his wife continued to proclaim her as the new bride in the family. The couple were relishing the moments of the conjugal ecstasy, excessive matrimonial joy, otherwise known as the period of honeymoon. They were the moments to be cherished in the memory and reminisced on the occasion of each anniversary with gratitude to Allah. However, the honeymoon at home was not perfect in its setting nor the period thereafter. The couple would want to steal a few short moments of being together holding hands as and when at leisure and alone in the privacy of their room during the daytime, which is normal for a newlywed couple. They couldn't. The mother continued with the old habit, since the childhood of the son, of appearing suddenly in his room. To her, nothing changed, nor did she want anything changed. The son and the room both remained the same within her domain, and her right to it remained the same. Locking the door meant banning her right. She would be the prosecutor, the jury, and the judge in a verdict against the bride as the scapegoat. There was yet another ramification. For the parents to barge in was to cause the son to reveal to his wife his annoyance to this habit of the parents. And consequently, he was offering a license to the wife to begin to develop a dislike for them. It will be no surprise if the son, as a child, had and still has the habit of curling himself in the bed while in the state of sleep. This, of course, may not be as much in that fetal, unborn baby in the womb posture as he was used to when he was a child. Curling posture. Curling himself in the state of sleep comes about instinctively to a child, especially the one with a slim physique, when the bedroom is normally cold or the child has a habitual subconscious fear of insecurity. That posture, like that of a coiled reptile, exposes the least possible body front to a threat to the body. There is yet one more reason. The instinctive curled posture offers the satisfaction of some semblance of privacy as the child begins to become conscious of the need for it. This is normal where a child goes to sleep early under the glare of light while others around him in the room are still wakeful, robbing him of the privacy for his sleep. In fact, the curling posture is part of the manifestation of the human instinct for self-preservation. The exposure to cold and the fear of insecurity of the body while in the state of sleep with the lack of privacy all seem to trigger this instinctive posture. The message is simple to the parents. Allow the growing child his moments of privacy also. Teach him to want his liberty to keep the door of his room partly closed, ajar, whenever he feels like doing so, and further teach him to expect his parents to call first or knock before entering the room. Personality. Teaching the child the enjoyment of his certain convenient moments of privacy in his room is one of those factors which determine the extent to which the child develops his independent personality. The child needs even more consideration from the parents, especially from the father, when the child is a girl. Where there is more than one child, the need for their moments of common privacy will still be the same and should be respected by their parents all the same. Besides, Teaching the child his own needs of the moments of privacy will teach him also to respect the parents' moments of privacy, which the Holy Quran too mentions in the verses 24:58-59. Such training serves as a mold for the rules of polished decorum within the family, and ensures respect and decency among the members. Let us remember that the first human experience, even before a person is born, is that he is conscious, aware, exists, and the first thing which he is conscious of is the privacy and comfort of the womb. The human will always prefer his moments of privacy and comfort. Personal privacy is now considered a human right, and there already exists laws against its intrusion in many countries. Childhood is no excuse for deprivation of privacy. The excuse is childish. Chapter 28. Save the child from risk of school antipathy. It was a primary school. The geography teacher asked for a volunteer among the pupils in the class. One of them was quick to oblige. He went to the Atlas Library, and brought a canvas roll of Africa map and, as enthusiastically, proceeded to hang the now spread canvas across the tripod blackboard. This practice, though usual, required some height and prior experience for any volunteer. On this occasion, however, the canvas map slipped from the hands of the pupil and fell onto the floor, much to his embarrassment. The mishap was greeted with a lively roar of laughter in the class. Surprisingly, the teacher got visibly angry. He thought that the pupil had obliged the classmates with an amusement at the cost of his respect as a teacher. The teacher asked the pupil to stand to attention in a corner of the class. The teacher, however, got further angry at the pupil when he saw that some of his classmates were making signs of teasing at him for his punishment, as if he was the one who was prompting the spectacle. So the teacher asked the pupil to go out and wait for him outside the office of the headmaster while he was continuing with his period. A real dilemma. The headmaster, on the other hand, finding the pupil outside his class missing his lessons, directed him to return to his lessons. The pupil, seeing himself in a real dilemma, decided not to venture back to face the teacher while he was in that ugly mood. Instead, he moved about in the lobbies until the period was over and returned to register his presence outside the office of the headmaster as instructed earlier by the teacher. Later, the teacher informed the headmaster that he was not surprised that the pupil had defied the instruction to return to his lessons, because he was already proving himself a cause of indiscipline in the class. He recommended punishment, and perhaps a note also to his parents. He was punished? The pupil, though already hurt, was relieved of the apprehension about an additional punishment at home when it appeared certain to him later that no communication was, however, sent to his parents by the school. Antipathy. The pupil feigned, pretended, severe headache and absented himself in the school to avoid the following period of the geography teacher. It was obvious that he was developing antipathy, a bitter dislike, towards the school as his only alternative to his emotional reaction to the injustice and humiliation meted out to him. Incidents of open injustice and humiliation are normally wrongly supposed to be accepted as a fair play and a normal part of the school experience by the victims, according to the parents' antiquated adage that the teacher is always right. It falls upon the victims, however, to suffer silently the agony of the memory of the humiliation for long periods of time, while hoping that the news of the incidents do not reach the ears of their parents. Their avenues for a redress do not exist. There happens to be also other avenues of injustice which are not uncommon in the school. Boys are subject to intimidation or punishment at the hands of some teachers when boys cannot help themselves being boys. Boys tend to be lively. And some even more than others, and this is often misinterpreted naively as misbehavior. Highly spirited. A teacher need hardly take it serious if, as an example, a pupil having raised his hand high chooses to wave it in the air vigorously to seek preference for answering a question that was directed to the class. To keep ignoring him purposely for being highly spirited is to be unkind. To warn him is to question his healthy sense of rivalry. A tactful response to put an immediate stop to this, if need be, is to announce, Those who are not sure of the answer can still raise their hands but wave them in the air, however, preference will be given to those who think that they know the answer. And there was this pupil who was chided and then mentioned in the assembly hall by the headmaster. His serious misconduct was to be imaginative and venture into some exercise of creativity. Toying with a pen, he drew spectacles across the face of a teacher peering from his picture. The pupil had made a use of his own copy of the monthly school magazine, for the exercise and for his own personal satisfaction of the moment. He might as well added two to give the face a distinguished touch, like his father's, who sported a beard and wore glasses. This is again an example of the din created disproportionate to the cause, if there was a compelling cause. The message? The message to the parents is to understand that such incidents of unfair treatment, punishment and humiliation are not uncommon in schools in general, and that they have a disastrous result. The victims develop antipathy towards the school and also towards his studies to ruin his aspirations and prospects for a pursuit of good education, and that the children, however badly hurt, avoid mentioning the incidents to the parents for fear of additional victimization. Parents should therefore discreetly pre-warn the children of such incidents of injustice. This will encourage the children to reveal these incidents to the parents for a balanced discussion, which can then be extended, if need be, with the school management respectfully and fairly, with the assurance that the intention is to assist both the child and the school. Only those who are wrongly punished and hurt will have the confidence of discussing the incidents with their parents. This will enable parents to protect their children from the risk of the children developing an antipathy towards the pursuit of education. At a private picnic of friends, studying in a primary school, there was a game session of making up a good story. This is from the author's own experience. One came up with a spontaneous story in which the bad guys were the teachers and the heroes the pupils in a fictional plot involving a school. Bandits had attacked the school to get after the bad teachers. Obviously, from the telltale signs, it is also a story of a victim of a school antipathy. He himself never knew that while he was spinning his fictional story, he was revealing the true story of his antipathy, which even he did not grasp. The ending is that he veered his way out while others found theirs into a secondary school. The author has reason to be still remembering the fictional story. He landed in a trouble when he repeated it during the dinner time that evening at home. That was way back in 1946. Have things changed with regard to the antipathy? Much. Then the author wouldn't be mentioning the story. Chapter 29. Make the child understand prejudice. Parents should not keep making the mistake, as many do across the world, of infecting their own children with the disease of prejudice from false ethnic pride. The disease spits out the poison of aversion or disdain, or worse, contempt for groups or communities of people only for the reason that they are different and not of us in race, culture, color or faith. Parents often groom their children into seeking a refuge or a sense of security against the people they had not known or even met. By looking down on them with an uneasy dislike because of fear or mistrust of them arising from the mere fact that they are perceived different. Parents do so unwittingly by being themselves vocal and liberal in expressing their sweeping prejudice in the presence of their children. The children trust their parents and accept their views, however preposterous or generalized, as well-based and true. What is worse, children take it as normal to harbor and peddle such lines of prejudice. People with such mental weaknesses are known as stereotypes and are a threat to Allah, Concord, so earnestly exhorted by Islam for the well-being of the human society. In the present world, which is now mere one global village, there is no room for the people who are stereotypes or the children who are reared as such. Who is a stereotype? A person who holds a false and prejudiced opinion about the entire community of people whom he perceives as different and because of his unpleasant experience, however isolated, with a member or two individually of that community. or the false opinion held was predetermined because it was also held by others of his own kind. The disease is infectious where ego and self-aggrandizement from stark ignorance abound. A stereotype will twist, distort, misinterpret or even ignore the hard facts or glaring truths simply because they conflict with his cherished opinions which never had any valid basis in the first place. At the slightest opportunity, he is ready to make a quantum leap into a whimsical conclusion to comfort him in his prejudiced views. It is a disease of attitude, mind, which is oft infected to the children by their parents, who themselves were also made victims during their childhood. Once infected, a remedy or remission is difficult where ignorance is perpetuated as a heavenly inspiration. In a society of Muslims, the presence of stereotypes should be uncommon. The stereotypes cannot hold and portray compassion for all mankind in common, while Islam, in a nutshell, is serving the Creator and showing compassion for his creatures, Hadith. Islam esteems the whole mankind as one people with no distinction with regard to race, tribe or color. It has, however, set one distinction, a spiritual one, transcending all others, and that is, those who are dutiful to Allah are the ones who are honorable in the sight of Allah. Verse 49:13. Stereotypes are prone to stooping further for an added comfort of their weakness. They will be seen peddling supposedly a righteous hate, again with no valid basis for it. Hate is even worse than prejudice. A child let toying with a prejudice to grow into hate is like letting him have a pet who grows into a monster, who later in life cannot be controlled, caged or made to disappear. And there was this child. There was this small child with her mate, seated in a public garden. She was deriving fun by engaging her maid in a game of teasing her sense of concern for the child. She would wander off away from her to prompt the maid to plead to her to come back. When the maid makes a move to stand up to go after her, she would sprint back and cling to her with her small arms around the maid's neck, and cheeks pressed hard against each other's to assure the maid that she is back safe. At times, the child would fondle the maid's ears or play with the maid's hair with her small hands in instinctive human attachment. It never dawns upon the child that they both are different in race and color from one another. Such a behavior of a child is always a manifestation of the inherent human nature free of contrasting behavioral traits which are acquired later. The Holy Quran is eloquent regarding this basic human nature of commonality by saying that all human beings are one single people, verse 5:48, with a common dignity to all mankind, verse 17:70. Any prejudice with regard to the fact that people, though one, are not one single Ummah, nation, is to question the Creator's wisdom, 11:118. Discourse and discussion of the subject mentioned in the verses with children at home at opportune moments are remarkably effective. Apart from other considerations, children will be saved from the unworthy emotions and their consequent effects on their mental and physical health. What is more, they as adults will understand well the weaknesses of other stereotypes and forgive when or if they themselves are the victims of prejudice or hate. Chapter 30. Handle the child's fragile trust with care. When this person was about 4 years old, his mother took him shopping with her. He wanted to be a big boy, so she gave him the money for a pint of milk and a loaf of bread. She placed a shilling in his right hand and said, "This is for the bread," then a shilling in his left hand and said, "This is for the milk." He ran happily into the store. After about 10 minutes, his mother got worried and came into the store to find her child in tears because he couldn't remember which shilling was for the milk and which for the bread. "Oh, darling. It didn't matter. The price is the same." The mother laughed with great amusement. The child didn't find it funny. The mother should have simply explained to the child that one shilling was for milk and one for bread. The child saw himself rudely cheated in return for having trusted the mother unquestionably. He tried to remember and follow her instructions precisely, having been made to believe that the shilling for bread was different from the shilling for milk. It is not surprising that after some 60 years the child, Now an aged person cannot wipe off from the memory this incident, which appeared petty to the parent, but emotionally upsetting for any child. Ripple effects. This father urges his child to join him in the swimming pool for the child's first experience in the mass of water, assuring him that he is safe in his father's hands. The child eventually yields and joins, only to find that the father was scaring him to death with the theatrics pretense of drowning him. It was a great fun to the father, worth joking about when he is back at home. However, to the child it was a rude violation of his trust in the parent. The memory of the experience and the embarrassment of the spectacle he had created in public would linger on. The erosion of a child's trust in parents produces ripple effects in significant degrees in his love, loyalty and obedience for the parents over a period of time. These are apart from other emotional aspects of his relation to them if his trust is misused or made fun of more as a practice than a rare exception. I was in the reception room of a dental clinic waiting for dental attention. Seated opposite me at the other side of the wall, among other patients, was an elderly lady with a small boy who appeared to be her grandchild. Strangely, the child seemed to be taking undue interest in me with his large inquiring eyes. After some time, seeing his interest yet undiminished, I directed to him a sign of come over and say hello, as if to break the proverbial ice. I had thought that with that signal the scrutiny by the vigilant child would cease. Say hello. Apparently, the gesture did not escape the sharp eyes of the grandmother. She asked the child, who was all the time standing by her side, to go over and say hello to uncle, and then showed visible anger and embarrassment when he would not budge despite her repeated prodding. Her sense of granny pride for the child's obedience was being publicly challenged. Seeing that I brought on myself a new and bigger situation I had not bargained for, I intervened. I spoke up to the lady in the presence of all who were stealthily playing spectators to the small drama, presumably to kill the boredom or divert their mind from the dread that lay ahead in the dentist's chair. I assured the grandmother that the behavior of the child was perfectly natural. He, being on guard, would not want to approach someone who was a stranger not only to him but also to her, and that would come only from a child who was alert and healthy in mind. Being alert must not be misconstrued as being shy. Self-preservation. The child obviously trusted his grandmother, but then he trusted his strong sense of self-preservation even more. Children's nature is to be wary of strangers, and this serves as an instinctive protection for the children who are vulnerable because of their age. Parents should not teach their children to compromise their instinctive shield, which is useful when they are individually alone outside their home. The lion cub raised as a pet and taught to trust human beings with the instinct of self-preservation seriously compromised is never let back into the wild jungle. In the same context, parents should leave the child's strong sense of self-preservation intact. They should not use his trust in them to disturb his inherent natural behavior of being wary of strangers. In fact, the parent's fulfillment of one important love for their child is the ability to retain the child's trust in them. It may not be as simple as said. No wonder, marriage and the upbringing of children in the home require as well-trained a mind and as well-disciplined a character as any other occupation that might be considered a career. It seems as if parents have to go to school to graduate in children's upbringing, such important is this subject in the human life. Let me end with this note: there is little for the parents to do about the length of childhood of their children, but can do much about its width and depth. It is rightly said that men are what their parents made them. Saying of Imam Ali, peace be upon him: wisdom is the lost property of the believer, let him claim it wherever he finds it.